Yeah, I'm four.
Okay. So we only had to reschedule 5 flights to be here with us today, but that's nothing for your young. So this talk is going to be on physical space amplitudes and unitary demand.
Okay. Thank you for the talk experience. And I will talk about physical space and amplitudes and unitarity. And this, my talk will include work together with Cipher, Stephen Diddle, Max Dixon, David Dunbar, Harold Hinton, Warren Perkins, and Casper Rizak. And that's the group at Swansea and in the US. And I will talk about the results in some of these papers, especially the Gravis papers, and this paper about the recursive calculations of one event. So the talk will be in basically 2 parts. But I will start a bit easy and introduce the subject, and then I will try to cover as much as possible. So the basic idea about looking at amplitudes in Swiss space is this duality due to Witten, that if you take perturbative n equals 4 super Yang Mills, he suggested that there's a topological string description and there's a twister target space, string theory for these amplitudes. And there's these very nice and very somehow geometric line structures for the amplitudes that suggest that amplitudes might be much simpler than we should expect. Because usually when we do calculations and it's called super Yang Mills, we end up having huge expressions. And it's really not possible to see any kind of fusion in them. But then when you transform them into twister space, you see that they really are localized and lines. And all this conjecture has led to a really huge activity. And during the last 2 years, there's been really a lot of good work. And there's been a lot of progress in calculating amplitudes. And I would say we are, at the moment, much closer to having sort of a formalism that could generate the results for QCD amplitudes that we need for colliders. So it has like a phenomenology in as well. And the basic idea so far is really to take some kind of inspiration from twist space or from somehow ideas that we have, and then try to look at the amplitudes and try to suggest that this expression should be simple. So the outline of what I will talk about today is that there's somehow two areas for field theories that are interesting for various reasons. There's the Yang-Mills field theories, which are all sort of related to QCD in some extent. If we do n equals 4, it can be seen sort of like we're trying to do QCD, but in a supersymmetric way. And since the motivation for all this work is really all the technology associated with the LHC collider, we will soon have new data from collider experiments, and we will have to test new physics, and we really need this large number of gluon expressions that one do to test stuff like supersymmetry, search for the Higgs. And then these new insights can be very useful. And on the gravity side, to some extent, theories for quantum gravity are always interesting. And the motivation is, of course, more theoretical, but there might be really new insights. And the work so far has shown that we still have a lot to learn, especially about supergravity. And especially, it's been quite interesting to investigate the twisted space structure of gravity amplitudes. So the original conjecture was really for Yang-Mills theory, but it seems that we can do the same for gravity really. So just a brief review of the spin at least formula. So the basic fact is that when we do Feynman diagrams, it's not really a very effective way of doing calculation, because you have a huge number of diagrams that you need to sum, and the number of diagrams you have to sum over will grow rapidly with the number of legs. in the expressions you have all these contractions of momentum, you have contractions with the polarizations, and all this stuff, you have no way of simplifying without specifying some kind of external polarization. So in order to rewrite or do something that might lead to some simplification, is to specify the external polarization sensors, but in a way that's related to the momentum in a nice way. And the spin-analytic formalism is such a formalism. And we use color ordering, that means we just look at leading color traces. And there's a lot, a set of techniques that we can use for these theories in order to build up amplitude expressions. We can use recursion at tree level. And for loop amplitudes, we have techniques like unitarity, so the symmetric decompositions. And all this stuff we can turn into very effective ways dealing with amplitudes. So when we do unicity, we use the basic fact that we can take the Lorentz group and we can write it in two sort of similar ways. And if we write it in terms of spinners and define these products and relate momentum vectors to each other, we can write a tensor version of the momentum vector in terms of spinner variables. And in this way, we can take amplitudes and rewrite dark products as these in terms of spinner vectors. And that's really the clue of this, is that we can define these polarization tensors for instance, gluons. And these polarization tensors are in terms of spin-analytic variables. So when we specify the unicities, we put in the polarization tensors, all of the amplitudes will be in terms of the spin variables. And that's the spin of this formula. So we avoided all the polarization contractions that would be in the Feynman diagrams. And we will have expressions for amplitudes which are very, very compact already from the Feynman diagrams. But that's somehow the next step is then to look for symmetries in these expressions and to see how simple they actually can be written. And there's a huge set of notation. I'll just mention a few things. We will need it a bit later. But we have these things we call S's, which is it's really just a mass over two legs. So it's a sum of two momenta that we square. Or the T's, that could be a sum of many legs that we square. We define these plane objects that is really spinner sums over a specific momentum. So in this case, this would be equal to this sum, where this A index is the indices of this momentum vector sitting inside. And there's also these things where we have a proper or a commutator terms inside. It's not so important, it's just formula. So I was talking about simplicity for amplitudes, and the most striking example of the simplicity, and that was already known before Witten suggested that amplitudes are line structures, are the MHV amplitudes. So when you start taking Feynman diagram expressions and you can reduce them to, or you can calculate amplitude expressions for various elicitors, you can see that if all elicitors are the same for a given amplitude expression at tree level, the amplitude will just vanish. And that goes for all n helicity being the same, or n minus 1 helicity being the same. And the first example where you discover really a difference, or you have a non-trivial amplitude, is when you go to the MHV level, where you have n minus 2 same helicities. And this amplitude was put in a very simple form by Park and Taylor. And it can be written in this one-line expression, where these R and S, slight mismatch, this should be the minus left, you take them to cubic or to fourth power, and you divide by this sticky trace over spinner products. And then you have an amplitude form in your field. And that is somehow, it's that formula that we suggested should be on the class. But in order to see that this amplitude has a line structure, we need to understand how we transform things into twister states. And all this stuff is really invented by Penrose. So what we do in order to see amplitude expressions in twister spaces, we make this Penrose transform, which is really turning all the... Remember when we defined the spinner products, we had the holomorphic spinner products in terms of like this, and the tilted one in terms of the dotted pieces. So when we take an amplitude and we take all the tilted indices and turn them into new data in its derivative expression, we make it a transform. And if we go to this complex metric signature of the plus plus minus minus two times the integer, we can see that this is really just a Fourier transform of the original amplitude. So once we take the MHV expression, and we make this transformation, since it's all holomorphic, we'll end up having a delta function in front, and that will make all the primes in the MHV expression lambda lines.
Could you remind us the relation between lambda and lambda tilde in 2.2 signature or in how are lambda and lambda tilde related in 2.2 signature?
What do you mean?
Well, are in Minkowski space for real momentum, how are lambda and lambda tilde related to each other?
They're just complex conjugates of each other.
Right. So you mean 2.2 signature? There's no relation.
There's no relation. I mean, they can be the tilde variables can be anything.
I mean, that's basically the reason why you can do the Fourier transform.
That's true. So I mean, you need this signature in order to write down the Fourier transform like this. In another signature, you wouldn't be able to do this.
Also, but because the spinners are real in 2.2 signature.
That's another thing. So it's always a bit of a hassle which signature to work, but. I mean, it's basically these products here. So if these are real, then the tilde variables will just be the complex conjugate, and they will be related. But if these are in a complex space, then these, the lambdas and the lambda tilde, are uncorrelated objects. So we can make a Fourier transform. But if we make the if we take the delta here and write out the relation between the mu and the lambda, that will give us the line structure. And then you can analyze more complicated amplitude expression, like amplitude expression with more minus ellipses, and these are called next to MHV, and they will be lying on two lines in the two systems. So there's some structure in this that you can see. And all this is really can be formulated in the CSW expansion, which the Charles has said you can win. So the basic idea is that we use the MHV amplitudes as building blocks for building up next MHV amplitudes expression. And that in this we need to make an optional description of the of this Q variable that will build into sort of a scalar propagator. And this is the description of how to do this, where we introduce this arbitrary reference spinner. And then you can see how the picture looks. We write out all the MHV vertices associated with a given amplitude. that's basically all the CSW factors that we need. And then we sum over all these contributions with the various vertices. And the basic picture would be like this, that we have two lines, like one line for each emitting vertex. And the field proof of this is, it's really a way to generate all this energy. So that sort of changed the world of the space. So now I will make a quick jump, but sort of review the basic features we need to look at the spin at this, and I will jump into loops because there's a lot to cover. So when we do calculations of trees, to some extent we are competing against numerics because all the expressions for scattering amplitudes at collider experiments, they are somehow already computed in numeric programs. So when we really want to do something that has a phenomenology impact, we need to do loops. And most of the loop calculations that we can do in perturbative physics is based on the Card equation. And the Card equation is actually this compressive equation up here, where we have this object that is referred to as the Card, which is related to the imaginary part of the one loop amplitude for a certain kinematic variable being real, or the square being bigger than zero. And the basic thing that we have to calculate then is this cut, which is based on the two trees that goes into to somehow subdividing. Or basically, if we want to calculate a loop, we calculate this cut, and this cut is defined in this way in terms of this tree and this integral here. And we can make a diagram of this, that we have a tree sitting on this side, and this tree could be have all sorts of helicity structures. In this case, I've drawn it as an MHV, and this side is also an MHV. And what we then do is that this cut is associated to what the tree sitting on the side is. We have two different choices for the helicity going across the cut. And we calculate this object. Then we go back and look at the one loop amplitude. And if we have somehow a justified basis for what the one loop amplitude should be, we can in any case simplify by using the information from the cut. We derive the one loop amplitude. And one of the amazing things in the following year has been these quadruple cut constructions where you can actually reduce, you can do more than one cut. You cut the tree again, and you can reduce loop calculations into these algebraic calculations where you do all possible cuts in a diagram. And I will return to this later.
Sorry, I'm sure everybody knows, but will you remind us what Lips
means? The Lips is the Lorentz invariant phase space integral. So it's the basic, that's the integral over these L's that we need to define. And that would be a measure associated with this. But the really good thing about the quadruple cut is that to some extent we don't need to perform it. That's one of the problems we need to face. But first, I just want to mention somehow what supersymmetry does for us, because supersymmetry is quite a neat way to organize amplitude expression. So when we do calculations of QCD amplitude, we can split it up into various supersymmetric parts. And I will show it with section and the next transparency. There's these three types of multiplets. Like you have the N equals 4, consists of a gluon and a fermion and a scalar. And there's the N equal 1 chiral that consists of a fermion and a scalar. So when you want to calculate a gluon amplitude, for example, you would start making the loop calculation for the N equals 4 multiplet. And because this has supersymmetry, it only consists of these boxes, these constructions. And these can all be fixed now by this little card. So basically, the N equal 4 bit is it's a solved problem today. Then there's the N equal 1 calculation where you need to sum over the full chiral multiplier. And there will be more integral functions since there's less supersymmetry in the graph. So there will be a basis of integral functions which consists of these graph functions, triangles, and bubbles. And I haven't written the integral functions out on this transparency because it's quite obvious actually how these integral functions look. But there will be, for instance, logs associated with each of these functions. But they have a natural separation in the graphs. I won't discuss the rest of the pieces just yet. So the basic idea is that we have a QCD amplitude for a gluon. We take the N equal 4 multiplied with sum, combine it with the N equal 1. So we can, for instance, this way we can subtract all the fermion contributions. So we're left with a gluon and a scalar. And then if we calculate this extra scalar contribution that we need, we have a QCD amplitude. And all this would be great. If not, once we do the scalar contribution, there will be some extra things that is not immediately fixed by the cards. But anyway, it provides us all the log terms for loop, if we do things this way. So what we thought about was, in this paper, what we did recursion for loops, was a possible way to avoid integration by really doing recursion for the loops. Once we do the loop, what we will end up is an expression that consists of a coefficient times this integral function, times some other coefficient for these integral functions, times some coefficients for these bubble functions. So what we were thinking about was somehow to construct some recursion principle that would allow us to really divide these coefficients by recursion. So what we would do would be to calculate loop coefficients for some number of legs, and then recursively build up loop coefficients to any number of legs. And the basic inspiration for this was, of course, these tree relations, the BCFW, by Brittaker, Charles, Feng, and Witten, which is another set of relations for calculating trees. I will review them in a minute, other than the CFW. And then that factorization properties for loop amplitudes are actually quite well understood. And there has been some work on this already, namely these finite loop amplitudes, which were calculated by Van Dixon and Cosmos, and the recursion for really doing rational pieces in one loop by also the same people, Klaus Stern and Ford and David Cosmos. But what we really wanted in this thing is really to calculate stuff, the gluon amplitudes that we can calculate just for using first order cuts. That is the N equal 1 contribution to loops, plus this scalar contribution. And then neglect the rest of these problem forming in it. So ECFW recursion was really, it's sort of a feedback thing that once one problem sort of gets solved, you get inspiration for doing another problem. So once all the N equal 4 boxes were calculated, it's possible to test these IR divergence terms. And that's a relation for the renormalization. So the thing is, once we do calculations of loops, we put these propagators in four dimensions. By this, we actually do a mistake because there's a dimensional regularization involved. And it's exactly this dimensional regularization that will make us have to add these rational pieces later when we do QCD. But in the integral functions, there will be some epsilon terms which are associated with the with this being away from four dimensions. And once we sum over all these terms, we should have this consistency relation that we have, that once we go to the limit of epsilon going from to zero, we should end up with the loop simplified. So once we have all these loop amplitudes for integers 4, we can simply sum over the ones that we know has to give 3. And in this way, we know that this 3, it might give a simple expression that we, for instance, calculate from C starting. And that's indeed the case if you look at these tables. But this has a deeper meaning than this. It's really related to the analytic properties of amplitudes. So there was this paper around January with a proof for the recursion trees, and that's what I wrote the review because we needed for the recursion of the functions. So the basic thing is that we take these spinner variables and we make this C-dependent shift. And that means that we take this amplitude and we shift the momentum into this combination. And once we do this, we obtain an expression for an amplitude which has a dependence in the complex plane. It has this C-variable. But the good thing is that the amplitude will stay unshelled because in this case, both lambda will be involved here. So when we square this, we'll get spinner products that will vanish. And then we can rewrite this formula in terms of Cauchy's formula, that we make this contour integral, we obtain the curve at infinity. And this curve at infinity we can rewrite as the value for z equal to 0 plus the sum of the residues inside this contour that we made. It's like a contour like this, and we have a set of poles. So if we have these three things that a 0 goes, that the c infinity vanishes, that a set is a rational function, and that we have these simple poles, we can take the amplitude expression that we want to calculate and reduce it to a sum over residues for the amplitude. And the good thing about trees is that we can, because the tree factorization properties are so simple, we can simply relate all the residues to the factorizations. So let's take an example. We have an amplitude, we have a kinematic invariant, and it goes to zero. And that will be a simple pole in this, like a term here. So what we do is we calculate the residue for that pole. And the residue, in terms of the formula, is given like this. We have a residue value where we have the pole. We have this kinematic invariant at the pole. And then we can build up this recursion formula for the amplitude. So if we want to do the same for loops, it seems that what we need is really just to look at the factorization properties. And if we understand the poles and the both the physical and the non-physical singularities, we can use that we have a basis of integrals to focus only on the rational pieces, the coefficient of the loop amplitude. And then in this way, we should be able to make some kind of recursion principle. And in many cases, there's starting expressions for recursions, because, for instance, there will be MHV expressions for these two four orders in
here. Can I ask you something about the previous slide? If you use that recursion relation many, many times, you can reduce any amplitude to a formula that only involves cubic couplings, right? Yeah. Cubic couplings. Do you have any idea what happened to the quartic couplings in Jamians?
Mm-hmm. it's not so clear. I mean, it's not something we have investigated. In principle, I mean, there might be a way that you could somehow, you might even to make it even more clever recursion this way. But I mean, I'm not so clear what it means.
I think it's just interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think also, like, I don't want to talk about gravity yet. So the thing is, we want to avoid logarithmic branch cuts because logarithmic branch cuts is not really, that's not simple folds. And we want to avoid the split edges. So let's go to the basic point. This is the factorization of a generic loop amplitude. So we have a one loop expression, we have a kinematic invariant. And once this invariant goes to zero, the amplitude split up into one loop contribution times this four and the three, and then the flipped version where the loop sits here and the three sits here. And then there will be these funny functions called non-factorization functions. And that is really because loop amplitudes are not that simple objects to investigate. And there will be kinematic invariants that might cross the pole. But what is nice about this function is that it's universal. So once you calculate it for a given loop amplitude, it will somehow, it will be the same. But we will try to do the simplest possible we can with this. So what we did was to look at the collinear singularities, and that singularities where you have a pole term associated with these S's. So when you have two momenta, and these two momenta become collinear, this product will vanish. And in this case, the full formula we had on the other case will only involve these two, this function called the split tree, which takes into account the previous transparency, the pole term combined with the tree. And in this case, this split loop term, which takes in you combine this object into the split tree. And you combine this object into the split loop. And that's the collinear factorization. And then you can write it out in terms of the input functions. So what we did was we chose a very specific example for n equals 1, where you only have these triangle functions. And in this case, we can see that the split tree sits outside this sum over integral functions, coefficients, and then there will be a split loop term. And then we went even more simple, we chose a case for the coefficient where we don't have this fact. So we chose very specific conditions for the and in this case, it really corresponds to having a factorization or a collinear limit where you have a bunch of legs. And inside this bunch of legs with two legs, which become collinear, become one momentum. And then we can simply get rid of the integral function using recursion. So we have the endpoint coefficient of this integral function. We just go into the split tree times the coefficient of that n is 1. And now we're back. This is like a tree relation. So the factorization that we're looking at will be like this. That instead of having a tree sitting here, we just have a coefficient for an integral function. And then we can write a recursion relation for this case. So in order to know that what we were doing was all right, it's possible that you just look at the cut. So you have a triangle function and you make the cut here. And if you can somehow, if you can justify that the tree sitting on this side is well behaved when Z goes to infinity, and there is no loop momentum kinematic pose, that is really the basic fact that this the Z shift that we will make, it doesn't tangle with this momentum. If we have these two conditions satisfied, we can prove that we can do this kind of recursion. So we look basically at all these split helicity amplitudes where this factorization is not present. And it was very satisfying to see that, the sufficiency criteria was satisfied and possible to prove. So instead of, going to the proof, I'll just give an example. So if we take, for instance, the 5-point final function going to the 6-point, we have this corner here. And this corner will be given in terms of the NHV formula, because this has to be plus and this has to be minus. And if we look at the tree, we can see that we can make a shift, for instance, on, 3 and 4. And this shift will only involve what sits on, the legs. It won't involve all the L's. And finally, when the set goes to infinity, this expression will vanish. So we can do the recursion. And therefore, we can write this formula down for the recursion. And that is the integral functions in this case. So we see that they involve these epsilon tensors and logarithms. And that is the n equals 1 chiral result. It involves these two k0 functions and this l0 function, which is really a logarithm. So when we look at the 5-point coefficient, we can suppose a shift like this. And what we need to do then is just to determine what is the residuum for the shift, what is the pole touch, and then we do a BCFW recursion as we are used to do it for trees. So we put in every place that we make the shift for the coefficient, this object, and every time we encounter a variable that shifts into the set plane, we put a hat. And then we put in all the hats, like in this case we have a 2-3 hat. We put in the hat, and the hat will shift 3 into a 4 with this step. Then we put in the residual value, and we can rewrite this object as this. And we can do all this manipulation for the coefficient, and the final result is, this compact. And that was very satisfying for us to see this. Half a year before, we really calculated this, and we got exactly the same expression. So we thought that we should be able to do all cases this way. So we went on with the 7-point and the 6-point. There will be more orders for recursion as you increase the number of legs. That's the basic permutation fact, that you have a number of legs, and if you want to add a plus or a minus, you could either start adding the plus and then the minus, or adding the minus and then the plus. And the end result won't be the same. So it means that as you go up, the number of terms will increase. But that's a very nice way that you can write this stuff. And that's in terms of these helicity diagrams, which is already also related to, zigzags. It's basically the same object. But so what you do is just you organize them, the number of shifts that you do. So in this case, if we start adding them, we look at some coefficient down here, and we want to add a number of pluses and minuses. So we can start adding minuses and then pluses, minuses, pluses, and we will end up here with this result. And what we need to do in order to get the full result up here is to sum over all these passes. So it's like and walking in a maze, and we just sum all the possible paths from A to B. And then we looked at, the recursion. And we were able to find a unified version for all types of tasks. So basically, you specify a elasticity diagram, and by specifying an elasticity diagram, you specify this variable PL, and you specify the variable PR. So in a given triangle, that is to specify how you will add plus minus legs on both sides of the triangle. And once you've done that, this formula gives the result for the term you need to add. And then you work out all the elasticity diagrams for the given amplitude you want to calculate. Use this formula with these substitutions. And then you can generate amplitudes. So the first example that we reproduced was another result for n equals 1 that we did. The next term is V, 3 minus case. So we have this expression. And doing it in terms of the formulas for the paths, you get exactly these expressions for the amplitudes. And in the scalar case, which is a completely new result, we found out that very little needed to be changed from doing n equals 1 to n equals 0. Basically, it's in this equation here. We need to change a few things, but it will all be inside the equation. So once we do the recursion, we end up having a very similar result. So basically, in this case, the d's become this, and the d becomes this, and we have this flip variable h. So this is really quantic amplitudes, because we know all the n4 results. And the trees were calculated in this paper by Richard Frank, Rockenstein, and Rolovich. And the n4 result for these amplitudes was given in a series of papers. So at the basic state of the art is really that we need all the rational pieces. So there was a paper by Steve Bernbixen afterwards, really giving a method for generating those once we know all the properties. So that's sort of it's all on the one level.
So is there any idea of autonomy on that?
The basic problem with going beyond one-loop level is that we need the basis. But a two-loop, it seems we can do so. At three loops, it gets more and more complicated. At one-loop level, it seems that these methods are quite efficient.
What about this? Would the same methods apply to two loops if you need the basis of?
The basic thing we're using is that we just make a cut, and that the cut corner we're looking at doesn't change under the recursion. We're just adding legs to a cut. So it seems that if you have a cut, and you can make the same justified criteria as we had on the, you can just add more legs in this case as well. Anyway, time is running, and I just want to say something about gravity. So for the gravity amplitudes, I will summarize this same thing later. For gravity amplitudes, there's a bunch of traditional methods for calculating amplitudes. And you can do, in Yang-Mills, you can do Feynman Lurgan to expand the gravity Lagrangian in terms of like a linear perturbation away from the real G. And then you make this perturbative expansion of the mu, and it will be in terms of this perturbation field H. You define all these vertex rules and you do Feynman Lurgans. And it's even worse than Yang-Mills because there's two indices instead of one. So everything gets completely messy. But there's a very nice relationship, which is due to string theory, that relates closed strings to open strings. And in this relationship, we can really calculate gravity amplitudes just from the Yang-Mills trees. And the basic somehow idea is that at 3-point level it's very explicit. We can just square 3-point angles vertices and get gravity. At 4-point it gets more messy because there will be some commutation flip inside. But still it's quite a nice formula. And what we found was that it's actually possible to do gravity loop amplitudes using the KLC relationship. So the basic idea is we use the quadruple cuts that I mentioned before, and that reduces all coefficient of box functions to algebra. So we had this cut integral, and there was this Lorentzian line and phase space. And we impose these four cut conditions corresponding to all the internal momentum legs being on shell. And once we do this, the complete coefficient, or the integral localizes, so the coefficient is just giving us a product of the three corners we have. And we just have to put in the solution for the L's that we have here. But if we take that for n equals 4, it's already known that in this way we can do one loop n equals 4 completely. But it was not so clear that we could also do gravity. But the basic feature is that if we can do Yang-Mills, we can also do gravity. Because the cut conditions will be the same for n equals 4 and for gravity, at least at the box function level. So we can take the tree for gravity, can use the KLT to write out the trees in terms of Yang-Mills. And for the coefficient, this means that if we take box functions for n equals 4, and we permute legs in this way, we can rewrite the product of these as n equals 8 to the gravity coefficient if we include these kinematic factors. So, at least for the boxes, we could actually write down the first expression for the 6-point gravity amplitude. And we found sample expression for doing 7, 8 endpoint expressions. So it seems that this formalism works. And then in this, we found a very curious result that we only included the box functions. And in fact, we should have included everything. We should have calculated the box function this way. Then we should have looked, is there any triangles and bubbles? But the basic feature is that as it appears at the moment, we don't see these terms. So you can do various sorts of checks. I mentioned the IR relations for doing n equals 4. And you can do the same sort of calculations in gravity. And we could use these 6-point expressions that we derived. And then what we see is only the singularities from box functions appear, and they give the complete singularity when the edge not goes to zero. So the basic statement is that at least at one loop level, it seems that we have the same power counting for n equals 8 as well for superconductors. One of the outstanding problems at the moment. It's a very curious fact. Another thing that we looked at in gravity was the twist space properties of supergravity. So if we look at the Yang-Mills MHV calculation, we have to include this delta function in order to have the twist space. So this is a twist space expression for the MHV, the line structure. And this delta function here describes the localization of the homomorphic variable line. But as we see, it's only a delta function. But in a gravity expression for n equals 8, there will be this polynomial in derivatives. And these derivatives will act in this delta function. And the basic fact is that once we do KLT, you write gravity as some polynomial in S times the product of the angles. And this polynomial in S will involve momenta, and momentum can be split up into list variables. of a holomorphic kind and an anti-holomorphic kind. And it's the anti-holomorphic kind that produces this polynomial and produces these derivatives on the double. So the localization properties in twisted space are not obvious from this. So we thought that the best way to attack was to use the UCLA supercomputer.
Is there an analog of the
Bayer-Taylor
relation?
There is an analog. There is the Behrens BPK, the BPK formula, and it works for MHV. And it's really derived from doing a KLT expression using the Behrens BPK formula. And then in a, I think they really played with numerics, that's what I know. And by playing with numerics, they were able to find the version of the MHV amplitude for gravity. And it looks pretty nice at 4 and 5 points, but at 6 points it started.
It has not been proven like the.
It has been proven numerically. But there's no. I mean, it's not really that much a nicer formula than the KLT, but it's a, somehow a compact way to put it on the computer.
And of course, how nice a formula is depending on group pace.
That's also another thing.
It's not that you can write down.
Yeah. It involves some quite complicated sums over various helicities. And there's definitely no like a line structure you can see immediately. But the thing is, if you throw a computer at these amplitudes, you can actually see that if you work on the MHV expressions and you put in actually, that's one thing. When Witten proved, or when Witten looked at the Jahn-Mills line structures, he wrote down these differential operators that is able to test if points lie on a line. So you pick some points here, and you write down this differential operator F. And that's we could also take the MHV amplitude and transform it into twisted space. But you can circumvent the problem, define a differential operator. And this differential operator will work in the original Dirichlet space. And by this means, you can test if things are on a line or if things are on two lines by this K operator. And we use the same operators. But you have to act with them more times because you have to kill all the derivatives sitting on the delta function. So you can test. But as you increase the number of legs, you have to act with this differential operator a number of times. And the same holds for the coplanar amplitudes like next term between. At 6 point, you have to act 3 times with this differential operator K, and at 7 point, 4 times K. And that is actually quite a numerical problem to do. But it suggests that this general path, that F acting on N is 0. If you have an N point, you should act N minus 2 times with F, or N minus 3 times with K. And that's much better than the power coming just coming from the KLT, because if you just sum the number of S's, and relate number of S's to the number of derivatives. You have this bound for the number of F's you need to apply. And this bound is much higher than the actual bound. So there's definitely some kind of twist structure in gravity. And since we had loop expressions, we found it amusing just to try out a few loop coefficients as well to see if they had some twisted space structure. And here the idea of doing quadruple cuts was very useful, because the basic idea is that once we've done the cut, we're simply acting on the tree. So if we make like the cut of 1, 2, and 3, act with the F on this, this would be an MHV, because it's a 5 point. We can go back to the tree relations and say, okay, it's a 5.3, how many F's should we apply? We should apply 3 F's. And then we could test it on the computer. And all these relations held true. So we get this set of relations. And it's even possible to make a twist-space picture of how the loop, the individual loops Christians will look like. And the amusing fact is that it's the same topology as doing an equal score. Just there will be a power associated with the differential operator. So that's more to investigate. Another thing that's very recently done is that we have made, we have looked at CSW type expansion for gravity trees. So in the same way as we can do BCFW for Young Mills, we can do it for gravity, and that was shown in these papers here. But a CSW expansion for gravity seems to be very far away. And the basic problem with doing CSW for gravity is that the same optical continuation that we produce in Young Mills, it's not obvious in gravity because there will be all these S factors, and therefore it's not so clear how we make the extension. But then there was this Danish student, Kasper Risager, and he invented this shift. And this shift, it reproduces CSW for angles. So the idea is that you take an amplitude, you apply the shift, and that puts in the amplitude expression in the CSW factorization form, that is this form. So we have a CSW or MHV vertices times scalar propagators. And the shift will automatically assure that everything is on the in the right way. So we just have to redo the BCFW proof once more. So we make the contour integral of the gravity amplitude. We have to make one assumption, which is hard to justify. That is that the integral vanishes at infinity. Since gravity involves all these S's, it's sort of very hard to find an analytic proof. But we could test that if you take a gravity amplitude and you impose the shift, we will have this vanishing contribution at least at lower point expression. And that was also the conclusion of your paper.
Well, we move for next
energy. Next energy. So at least in this case, we can write out this formula for the residuum and relate it to the amplitude. And then, since the shift will factor as everything in terms of MHV times the scalar propagator and MHV, we can just plot the shift, and we can see how the p hats, the optical p's, transform. So if we have all the angle brackets, the p will transform into these quantities, and that's no different from the normal system. I mean, that's just the how the angles are off-shell related to the eters. The interesting fact comes when we look at the brackets, because the brackets was a problem that was the objects that we couldn't find in our off-shell form. And we see when we move to make a shift, they move into this where one of the negative helicities that sits on the other side of the factorization actually comes into play. So at next to MHV we'll have a tree, and this tree will split into MHV diagrams. And we have a P. And then we could have a minus list sitting here and two minus list sitting here. So we want to find the CSW version or the optical configuration of this MHV vertex. But we see that we actually have to include information about the minus leg sitting here. So it tells us that there's actually a kind of non-locality issue with this description. But anyway, it is a CSW type expansion for gravity. It just involves these terms with the M1, which are really contact terms because they have a P. So it's like you make a CSW expansion where you have scalar propagators. And then you have to somehow take into account that there will be some kind of contact terms without propagators. And these contact terms can then be found via these substitutions. So I don't know how useful this construction really is for calculating amplitude, but it has some theoretical value. So just to conclude, it's already 5 minutes past. We have looked at amplitudes in QCD, and it is kind of obvious that if we can use previous results to calculate anything, it's much preferred rather than starting from scratch each time. And a good way to calculate loops is via unitarity, but that might even be more complicated. And recursive techniques are really something to prefer. And a good thing in this is that we can avoid integrations. We've seen that we can do recursion in some cases for some expressions, and that we have this set of sufficient criteria for making a valid recursion. It should, however, be said that these are not necessarily the necessary conditions. So we might actually be able to relax the criteria and still have valid recursions. It's just not so obvious what to choose. And this applies to a large class of frictions, all these specialist amplitudes, which is really an infinite set of amplitudes. The only problem is that for phenomenology interest, you really need everything, and you also need amplitudes which are not split. And so far, we haven't been able to see what a shift should be in a case with non-split amplitude. So it's not so clear if we can really do loops, all loops this way. But as we have seen, usually when new methods are invented that builds on these methods, and it's definitely clear that we need additional results for LHC. So there's still some way to go. When it comes to gravity, I think the fact that gravity has line structures in a CSW way is a very interesting fact, because it's actually, a priori, we shouldn't assume anything about gravity amplitude. I mean, we shouldn't think that it had anything to do with Young Mills. So what might be a possibility is actually that we might have a possibility of having a gravity twist string as we have for Young Mills. And at least the CSW expansion is possible. So that's definitely more important about it. So thank you.
Any questions? Yes.
Ultimately, one asks, can any of this be renormalizable?
In some sense, you can answer this question in many ways. I mean, you could say, what are you wanting for? I mean, you can have gravity as somehow an effective field theory. So in that sense, gravity is renormalizable. Another way is somehow that there's still, I mean, the possibility, there's a n equal a possibility where somehow you could say, is n equal a finite or is it not finite? It's not been proven to be not finite. I think the state of art is that there is.
You can always say a is counter term, what, 6 to 7 loops or something, but nobody has calculated the coefficient. Yeah. So maybe you can calculate the coefficient.
True, that's, at least that's something. But what do you mean? You want, I mean, definitely, gravity is not renormalizable like at Einstein-Hilbert action level. I mean, only in an effective sense. So you need supersymmetry to some extent to have a finite field. And some neurons.
So I think it was using supersymmetry, superspace formalism, or things like
you
that.
You can write down a counter term.
Well, if people wrote down something at 3 loops, but then these guys showed that there is nothing at 3 loops. So people went back to the superspace formulation, they found there was a mistake, and then they tried to push the thing forward again, and they found something at 6 loops.
Right.
But this guy hasn't, they haven't been able to go up to 6 loops. Right. So, If they may not mistake the three loops.
More likely that.
Well, some people would like to forget that any process for gravity is actually finite.
Well, if you could find a twist of structure that gives you.
Well, that's already in Ed's paper. Okay. He says that if there is such a thing, then this raises the possibility to.
So he raises the possibility that any good idea is finite.
Yes. I'm reading his paper. He says that if there is.
Is there any idea of whether this if can be realized? Have any idea?
It's not so clear. I mean, there's definitely things you can test. I mean, like you can say that the one loop hypothesis that we made, that we only have the boxes of one loop, is already some kind of indication in this direction. Because we really miss a set of integral functions, so there's some additional calculations that.
And they were supposed to be there.
They're supposed to be there. So there's some cancellation in descriptions that we see already. So I mean, to understand just how does this work.
And this beyond supersymmetry,
the
only possibility that you could have had.
It would be
yes, it's a miracle beyond any supersymmetry.
What we really need is somehow a better formula for writing gravity amplitude. I mean, the KLT relationship is really nice, but the problem is that once we make this product of Yang-Mills amplitudes and we flip legs, we introduce additional poles, so we can have like a 4-point. The product of this will actually contain double poles, but then we have a polynomial in S sitting outside, and that cancels poles. So what we need is really a very clear expression for how gravity is related to Yang-Mills, and then we might be able to see how things work. The Kelsey formula really has too much permutation involved. It's really too hard to see how any cancellations appear. But I mean.
And what do you think about conformal supergravity?
We looked at it in terms of the CW expansion. But I mean, one obvious comment is that in this factorization, if you have conformal supergravity, you should have, I mean, double folds. So they are not simple, so you cannot do the trick of relating to the sequels. But I mean, I guess if you may have a double fold, you might have you could take the derivative, or you can, meaning, there would be some way you can relate to residuum, but it will not be the amplitude, but a complex transform of it. So I don't know. There might be CSW expansion for conformal supergravity.
Well, that's the one that shows up in twist or trick the way it's formulated.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, you can say that doing n equals a supergravity is the wrong theory to work with in terms of twister space, because you should really work with conformal the supergravity. But it works. But somehow.
Any more questions? No? Let's thank you again.